Chapter 9. He ended by giving her back a laugh as frank as her own, and declaring, as he dropped her hands, colon all that and more to you'll see. Via, all day, since the late reluctant dawn, the rain had come down in torrents. It streamed against Darrow's high-perched windows, reduced their vast prospect of roofs and chimneys to a black oily huddle, and filled the room with the drab twilight of an underground aquarium. The streams descended with the regularity of a third day's rain, when trimming and shuffling are over, and the weather has settled down to do its worst. There were no variations of rhythm, no lyrical ups and downs. The gray lines streaking the panes were as dense and uniform as a page of unparagraphed narrative. George Darrow had drawn his armchair to the fire. The timetable he had been studying lay on the floor, and he sat staring with dull acquiescence into the boundless blur of rain, which affected him like a vast projection of his own state of mind. Then his eyes traveled slowly about the room. It was exactly 10 days since his hurried unpacking had strewn it with the contents of his portmanteau. His brushes and razors were spread out on the blotched marble of the chest of drawers. A stack of newspapers had accumulated on the center table under the lectrolier, and half a dozen paper novels lay on the mantelpiece among cigar cases and toilet bottles. But these traces of his passage had made no mark on the featureless stillness of the room, its look of being the makeshift setting of innumerable transient collocations. There was something sardonic, almost sinister, in its appearance of having deliberately ate up for its anonymous part, all in noncommittal drabs and browns, with a carpet and paper that nobody would remember, and chairs and tables as impersonal as railway porters. Darrow picked up the timetable and tossed it onto the table. Then he rose to his feet, lit a cigar, and went to the window. Through the rain he could just discover the face of a clock in a tall building beyond the railway roofs. He pulled out his watch, compared the two timepieces, and started the hands of his with such a rush that they flew past the hour and he had to make them repeat the circuit more deliberately. He felt a quite disproportionate irritation at the trifling blunder. When he had corrected it, he went back to his chair and threw himself down, leaning back his head against his hands. Presently his cigar went out, and he got up, hunted for the matches, lit it again, and returned to his seat. The room was getting on his nerves. During the first few days, while the skies were clear, he had not noticed it, or had felt for it only the contemptuous indifference of the traveler toward a provisional shelter. But now that he was leaving it, was looking at it for the last time, it seemed to have taken complete possession of his mind, to be soaking itself into him like an ugly indelible blot. Every detail pressed itself on his notice with the familiarity of an accidental confidant. Whichever way he turned, he felt the nudge of a transient intimacy. The one fixed point in his immediate future was that his leave was over, and that he must be back at his post in London the next morning. Within 24 hours he would again be in a daylight world of recognized activities, himself a busy, responsible, relatively necessary factor in the big whirring social and official machine. That fixed obligation was the fact he could think of with the least discomfort, yet for some unaccountable reason it was the one on which he found it most difficult to fix his thoughts. Whenever he did so, the room jerked him back into the circle of its insistent associations. It was extraordinary with what a microscopic minuteness of loathing he hated it all. The grimy carpet and wallpaper, the black marble mantelpiece, the clock with a gilt allegory under a moldy bell, the high bolstered brown counterpaned bed, the framed card of printed rules under the electric light switch, and the door of communication with the next room. He hated the door most of all. At the outset, he had felt no special sense of responsibility. He was satisfied that he had struck the right note, and convinced of his power of sustaining it. The whole incident had somehow seemed, in spite of its vulgar setting, and its inevitable prosaic propinquities, to be enacting itself in some unmapped region outside the pale of the usual. It was not like anything that had ever happened to him before, or in which he had ever pictured himself as likely to be involved. But that, at first, had seemed no argument against his fitness to deal with it. Perhaps but for the 3 days' rain he might have got away without a doubt as to his adequacy. The rain had made all the difference. It had thrown the whole picture out of perspective, blotted out the mystery of the remoter plains, and the enchantment of the middle distance, and thrust into prominence every commonplace fact of the foreground. It was the kind of situation that was not helped by being thought over, and by the perversity of circumstance he had been forced into the unwilling contemplation of its every aspect. His cigar had gone out again, and he threw it into the fire, and vaguely meditated getting up to find another. But the mere act of leaving his chair seemed to call for a greater exertion of the will than he was capable of, and he leaned his head back with closed eyes, and listened to the drumming of the rain. A different noise aroused him. It was the opening and closing of the door leading from the corridor into the adjoining room. He sat motionless, without opening his eyes, but now another sight forced itself under his lowered lids. It was the precise photographic picture of that other room. Everything in it rose before him, and pressed itself upon his vision with the same acuity of distinctness as the objects surrounding him. A step sounded on the floor, and he knew which way the step was directed, what pieces of furniture it had to skirt, where it would probably pause, and what was likely to arrest it. He heard another sound, and recognized it as that of a wet umbrella placed in the black marble jamb of the chimney piece, against the hearth. He caught the creak of a hinge, and instantly differentiated it as that of the wardrobe against the opposite wall. Then he heard the mouse-like squeal of a reluctant drawer, and knew it was the upper one in the chest of drawers beside the bed. The clatter which followed was caused by the mahogany toilet glass jumping on its loosened pivots. The step crossed the floor again. It was strange how much better he knew it than the person to whom it belonged. Now it was drawing near the door of communication between the two rooms. He opened his eyes and looked. The step had ceased and for a moment there was silence. Then he heard a low knock. He made no response, and after an interval he saw that the door handle was being tentatively turned. He closed his eyes once more. The door opened, and the step was in the room, coming cautiously toward him. He kept his eyes shut, relaxing his body to feign sleep. There was another pause, then a wavering soft advance, the rustle of a dress behind his chair, the warmth of two hands pressed for a moment on his lids. The palms of the hands had the lingering scent of some stuff that he had bought on the boulevard. He looked up and saw a letter falling over his shoulder to his knee. Did I disturb you? I'm so sorry. They gave me this just now when I came in. The letter, before he could catch it, had slipped between his knees to the floor. It lay there, address upward, at his feet, and while he sat staring down at the strong slender characters on the blue-gray envelope, an arm reached out from behind to pick it up. Oh, don't, broke from him, and he bent over, and caught the arm. The face above it was close to his. Don't what? Ache the trouble, he stammered. He dropped the arm and stooped down. His grasp closed over the letter, he fingered its thickness and weight, and calculated the number of sheets it must contain. Suddenly he felt the pressure of the hand on his shoulder, and became aware that the face was still leaning over him, and that in a moment he would have to look up and kiss it. He bent forward first, and threw the unopened letter into the middle of the fire. Book 2, X. The light of the October afternoon lay on an old high-roofed house which enclosed in its long expanse of brick and yellowish stone the breadth of a grassy court filled with the shadow and sound of limes. From the escutcheon piers at the entrance of the court a level drive, also shaded by limes, extended to a white barred gate beyond which an equally level avenue of grass, cut through a wood, dwindled to a blue-green blur against a sky banked with still white slopes of cloud. In the court, halfway between house and drive, a lady stood. She held a parasol above her head, and looked now at the house front, with its double flight of steps meeting before a glazed door under sculptured trophies, now down the drive toward the grassy cutting through the wood. Her air was less of expectancy than of contemplation. She seemed not so much to be watching for anyone, or listening for an approaching sound, as letting the whole aspect of the place sink into her while she held herself open to its influence. Yet it was no less apparent that the scene was not new to her. There was no eagerness of investigation in her survey. She seemed rather to be looking about her with eyes to which, for some intimate inward reason, details long since familiar had suddenly acquired an unwonted freshness. This was in fact the exact sensation of which Mrs. Leath was conscious as she came forth from the house and descended into the sunlit court. As he had come to meet her stepson, who was likely to be returning at that hour from an afternoon's shooting in one of the more distant plantations, and she carried in her hand the letter which had sent her in search of him. But with her first step out of the house, all thought of him had been effaced by another series of impressions. The scene about her was known to satiety. As he had seen give her at all seasons of the year, and for the greater part of every year, since the far-off day of her marriage, the day when, ostensibly driving through its gates at her husband's side, as he had actually been carried there on a cloud of iris-winged visions. The possibilities which the place had then represented were still vividly present to her. The mere phrase French Chateau had called up to her youthful fancy a throng of romantic associations, poetic, pictorial and emotional, and the serene face of the old house seated in its park among the poplar beordered meadows of middle France, had seemed, on her first sight of it, to hold out to her a fate as noble and dignified as its own mien. Though she could still call up that phase of feeling it had long since passed, and the house had for a time become to her the very symbol of narrowness and monotony. Then, with the passing of years, it had gradually acquired a less inimical character, had become, not again a castle of dreams, evoker of fair images and romantic legend, but the shell of a life slowly adjusted to its dwelling. The place one came back to, the place where one had one's duties, one's habits and one's books, the place one would naturally live in till one died. A dull house, an inconvenient house, of which one knew all the defects, the shabbinesses, the discomforts, but to which one was so used, that one could hardly, after so long a time, think oneself away from it without suffering a certain loss of identity. Now, as it lay before her in the autumn mildness, its mistress was surprised at her own insensibility. As he had been trying to see the house through the eyes of an old friend who, the next morning, would be driving up to it for the first time, and in so doing she seemed to be opening her own eyes upon it after a long interval of blindness. The court was very still, yet full of a latent life. The wheeling and rustling of pigeons about the rectangular yews, and across the sunny gravel, the sweep of rooks above the lustrous grayish purple slates of the roof, and the stir of the treetops as they met the breeze which every day, at that hour, came punctually up from the river. Just such a latent animation glowed in Anna Leath. In every nerve and vein she was conscious of that equipoise of bliss which the fearful human heart scarce dares acknowledge. She was not used to strong or full emotions, but as he had always known, that she should not be afraid of them. She was not afraid now, but she felt a deep inward stillness. The immediate effect of the feeling had been to send her forth in quest of her stepson. She wanted to stroll back with him and have a quiet talk before they re-entered the house. It was always easy to talk to him, and at this moment he was the one person to whom she could have spoken without fear of disturbing her inner stillness. She was glad, for all sorts of reasons, that Madame de Chantelle and Effie were still at Ouchy with the governess, and that she and Owen had the house to themselves. And she was glad that even he was not yet in sight. She wanted to be alone a little longer, not to think, but to let the long slow waves of joy break over her one by one. She walked out of the court and sat down on one of the benches that bordered the drive. From her seat as he had a diagonal view of the longhouse front and of the dome chapel terminating one of the wings. Beyond a gate in the courtyard wall, the flower garden drew its dark green squares and raised its statues against the yellowing background of the park. In the borders, only a few late pinks and crimson smoldered, but a peacock strutting in the sun seemed to have gathered into his outspread fan all the summer glories of the place. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.